Chapter 15. I am not sure how long I was underwater, long enough to draw my Beretta from the holster inside my waistband. I surfaced with the dock between Smith and myself, hearing the outboard revving and the dock creaking ominously as the nylon rope strained at the cleat. My mouth, full of lake water, tasted like I'd been sucking on a bullfrog. What I thought was a second shot turned out to be the snap of the stern line as it finally gave way. Treading water, I watched John Smith's newly freed boat accelerate down the lake. I hadn't been this pissed off in a long time. I tossed my handgun onto the wet planks and pulled myself up from the lake in one motion. Because I had water in my ears, I had trouble hearing the old man calling to me. Finally, I saw him motioning from his own dock. A blue and white runabout rocked in the wake Smith had left behind. "We can catch him!" he shouted. Dripping, I stooped to grab my Beretta. When I straightened up, I saw that the tanned man was already idling toward me in his motorboat. His was a superior craft to Smith's in every respect. It had a windscreen and a cockpit with two seats and a steering wheel. Most importantly, it had a muscular four-stroke Mercury engine. As he swung alongside the dock, I leaped aboard.
"What's your name?"
"Max Glassman."
"I'm Mike Bowditch. I'm a game warden."
His shiny brown skin smelled strongly of coconut.
"I figured you for a cop. The Mook's criminal associates travel in packs. That's what my partner and I call them."
Smith was heading south at a good clip, but the aluminum boat squared off bow slowed his speed. The boat bounced off every wave, nor did its captain seem to realize he was being pursued.
"Thank you for helping me, Max." I holstered my wet weapon. "Your neighbor is more dangerous than I'd realized." "I would say so."
I glanced around the boat and located a personal flotation device.
"Would you put this on for me, please?"
"You're kidding.
I'll hold the wheel."
When he saw I wasn't joking, he took the vest and pulled it over his wiry shoulders.
"What about you? Don't you have to put one on too?"
"I should," I said, taking the opportunity to slow the engine to the faintest crawl.
"You're a good swimmer, Mr. Glassman. I can tell. If you weren't, I wouldn't do this to you."
His eyes widened as the meaning of my words hit home. By then, it was too late. I had grabbed him firmly by the biceps and with a twist of my hips flipped him over the side. The vest kept his head from going under, but he managed to swallow some of the lake.
"I can't have you in the boat if he's shooting at me," I shouted. "I'll be back to get you as soon as I can." "You can't just... The state will reimburse you for any damage to your boat. You have my word on that." "Damage?"
He had floated far enough away that I felt safe to give the engine some gas. I turned the wheel to keep the prop from splashing him. Even above the roar of the outboard, I heard the native New York obscenities he lobbed after me. By this time, Smith had realized he was being chased. He had opened up his two-stroke engine, heading for the narrows between the upper and lower lake. I was unfamiliar with this body of water beyond the vague memory of seeing it in a dog-eared atlas. I gave a guilty glance back at Glassman and was relieved to see that he was already crawling toward the near shore, swimming with well-practiced strokes. Exigent circumstances had come to define my life. The runabout was a pure pleasure to drive. If the engine wasn't new, it had been perfectly maintained. I didn't crash into the waves the way Smith did, but skipped over them, feeling the bounce as ripples up my spinal column. As I closed the distance, I began to worry that Smith was stupid enough to open fire again. I had no interest in engaging in an aquatic gunfight with this weirdo, especially when a jet ski might show up at any second. I had more than enough deaths on my conscience. Fortunately, the ominous weather was keeping other boaters off the lake. Off to my right, I saw the wetlands where the river entered the lake, and up ahead, more of the same emergent vegetation, arrowhead, pickerel weed, and cattails hemming the narrows. I plotted an intercept course. I gunned the engine and shot forward at 40 miles an hour. My acceleration was so sudden I had to grab the windscreen to keep from sliding. My burst of speed caught Smith off guard. He must have dropped the pistol trying to draw a bead on me because I saw him glancing desperately around the bottom of the boat. As I roared up on his port side, He lifted his head, realized he was heading into the thick of the marsh, and gave the outboard a jerk back toward the thoroughfare. What he'd failed to see was the half-submerged log in front of his bow. The boat struck the dead tree with a terrific noise, the same metallic shriek you hear during a car crash, and slammed to a stop. The collision caused Smith to tumble forward and over the gunwale nearest to me. He must have struck his skull on one of the aluminum seats because he went down like a lead weight. I backed off the bow rider to a safe distance, tossed out the mushroom anchor, and dived headfirst into the lake. In the shallows, the water was as warm as a baby's bath. Unidentifiable clumps of vegetation torn loose by the roots floated before my eyes, along with sand stirred up from the bottom. I kicked hard toward the spot where I'd seen Smith go under, hearing the thwack, thwack, thwack of his still-spinning propeller. If he had been using a dead man's switch, the engine would have gone off the second he fell overboard. I stayed down as long as I could, trying to peer through the shimmering sand, feeling that incomparable sensation when you begin to run out of oxygen and your brain becomes a circus balloon expanding inside your skull. Finally, I popped up to fill my lungs. I scanned the surface for a floating body. Seeing none, I dived down again, disturbing a musk turtle that had been trying to pass unnoticed along the bottom. I saw sunken beer bottles, but no Smith. If I didn't find the unconscious man soon, assuming he was unconscious, he would drown. The third time I rose to the surface, I realized that I'd been played. I began swimming at top speed toward Max Glassman's runabout. Sure enough, Smith had already pulled himself into the bobbing craft. However bad a tumble he had taken, he hadn't been knocked cold. He had a fresh cut on his head. Blood streamed along his jawbone and dyed his salt-and-pepper beard pink. He was pulling up the anchor hand over hand as I came up on him. Maybe he thought he could hurl the toadstool-shaped weight at me, but I was too close. He threw himself forward into the cockpit, desperate to restart the engine before I could gain a handhold on the swimming ladder. "Hey!" I said. "Asshole!" Distracted, desperate to flee, he ignored me. "You're not going anywhere! Not without these!" I raised my right arm out of the water like Excalibur from the mirror. My middle finger protruded through the steel ring that held the keys to Glassman's boat. Chapter 16. I drew my Beretta from its Kydex holster and trained the sights at him while treading water. "Don't think it can't fire because it's wet. Now raise your hands above your head." As he followed my instructions, his robe parted, revealing a belly emblazoned with offbeat motorcycle tats. "Don't worry, be horny. Adventure before dementia. Loud wives lose lives." He'd even had blood-red bullet holes tattooed across his abdomen. "Back up to the bow while I climb up," I said. "I will shoot you if you so much as flinch. That's a promise, not a threat." Clutching the keys tightly in my palm, I used that hand to pull myself up until my waterlogged boots found the bottom rung of the swimming ladder. Then I stood up carefully. If Smith had thought to rock the boat, I might have lost my balance and fallen back into the lake, but he had come to terms with the reality of his predicament. John Smith stood in the bow with his hands raised. There were bits of plant matter, torn rushes and pondweed, in his bloody beard. It was my first real look at the man in the flesh. Underwater, he had lost all but one of the bandages from Charlie's alleged assault. The exposed wounds were ugly in the extreme. There was a laceration stitched with black sutures under his right eye, and a blue-green bruise under the left. There was yet another contusion on his bald temple. "Turn away from me," I said in my most commanding voice, "and kneel down." Not that I needed to fake the anger. "I can't kneel. I'm disabled." I understood now what Carol Boyce had meant about Smith being but a ruin of a man. His body was all out of kilter. One rounded shoulder rose higher than the other. That knee didn't bend. I wondered how many months he'd spent in the hospital after the motorcycle crash that I guessed had rearranged his skeleton. I ordered him to lift his hand while I cuffed one of his wrists. He didn't fight me, but he didn't help either. I dragged him to the cockpit. I pushed him down in the passenger seat, his bad leg extended out straight, and cuffed his wrists together behind the seat back. "You and I are going to have a conversation," I said. "But first, I need to make sure your neighbor isn't adrift out there."
"Fuck that Jew," he said.
I swatted him on the side of his shaved head. He glared at me. I stuck the key into the ignition and restarted the engine, then turned the runabout around and began cruising north toward the spot where I'd jettisoned Max. Halfway up the lake, I slowed and surveyed both shores. There was no trace of Glassman, but I sighted his orange life vest hanging from a piling at the end of someone's dock. I had been correct in my judgment that the lean man was a daily swimmer. Still, I faced a difficult explanation at best and a potential lawsuit at worst.
"What are you doing now?" Smith asked.
"What does it look like I'm doing? I'm dropping anchor."
"What the fuck for?"
"You're going to answer my questions before I bring you back to shore."
"Who are you?"
"A friend of Charlie Stevens." At the mention of the pilot's name, Smith's mouth trembled. There could be no question that my friend had inflicted the lopsided man's injuries. I could scarcely believe it.
"You said you were police," he said. "You could have been anyone."
"We're not in an interrogation room, Mr. Smith. No one is recording us. The sooner you tell me the truth, the sooner we can get off this lake. I want to know about the badge."
"What badge?"
"The one my friend took from you in Machias."
"He stalked me, that motherfucker. Stalked me all the way up here. And then he forced his way inside my house and beat me to a pulp. It was embarrassing, a guy that old."
"You must have provoked him."
"He's got Alzheimer's or something. He should be locked up in a nursing home."
"Describe the badge."
"It was brass, tarnished, and said State of Maine Warden on it."
"Was there an identifying number?"
"Maybe. I don't remember. Look, I'm going to catch hypothermia if we stay out here."
I grabbed his rigid knee to turn him toward me. "By now you probably realize that I can be a pretty violent guy myself. What was the number on the badge?"
113.
The digits meant nothing to me, but clearly they had mattered to Charlie.
"And where did you acquire it? I want the truth." "People bring me things. I give them cash up front if I think I can make some scratch. It's just normal, everyday business."
"Which people?"
"People who have stuff they don't know what to do with."
I sat down across from him in the driver's seat. "What happened to you, Smith?"
"What do you mean?"
"You crashed your bike, right?"
"Hit a moose. I should be dead."
"Where?"
"Route 11, north of Ashland. That road is fucking Moose Alley."
"I believe you," I said. "Hearing you tell the truth is helpful because it makes me appreciate what a talented liar you are."
"Fuck you!"
I put my hand on his knee as if to wrench it, but restrained myself.
"What is it with you game wardens? Can't you see I'm handicapped? This is more police brutality."
"You just tried to murder me, asshole."
"I didn't know who you were or what you wanted. You look dangerous. You are dangerous."
"That's a common problem for you, having dangerous men show up at your door?"
"When you live in the sticks."
"Here's the deal. The police are going to be waiting for us when we get back to shore. I don't know how your other neighbors respond when they hear a gunshot on the lake, but I'm pretty sure Mr. Glassman has called the cops."
"I was in fear for my life, and when I saw you chasing me in Max's boat..."
"How long have you been selling stolen merchandise?" His lip began to tremble again, but not from the cold. "That's a big part of your business," I said. "Selling items brought to you by burglars? Heroin and meth addicts need quick cash for drugs. The problem is that pawn shops are pretty well policed, and the cops keep an eye on Craigslist and eBay. It's not so easy for non-professional thieves to find fences."
"That's a bogus accusation."
"We'll see what turns up in your house."
"You have no grounds for a warrant."
"Judges tend to be permissive when a person opens fire on a law enforcement officer. but I'm not sure your biggest worry is what the cops are going to find inside your garage. I'd be more concerned about my criminal associates hearing you were spilling their names as part of a plea deal. He jerked his head up.
I would never.
But how can they be sure?
You'd lie and put my life in danger?
Fear had made his voice into a thin squeak. You tried to shoot me, asshole! Back at the northeast side of the lake, I saw blue lights pulsing amid the trees. At least one state trooper had arrived. Have it your way, I said.
I bought the badge at a yard sale, Smith said. I bought it from a college girl up in Presque Isle who didn't know what it was.
Chapter 17. Smith didn't remember the address of the yard sale where he'd purchased the badge, but he knew the street in Presque Isle, which was something. Less helpful was his description of the woman who'd sold it to him.
Great tits, and she liked showing them off. She kept leaning over the table, and she was wearing those basketball shorts with the stripes up the side. Nice ass, too.
What about her face? I asked. I'm assuming she had one.
You wouldn't have needed to put a bag over her head or anything.
I resisted the urge to swat him again. What color were her eyes?
Brown.
And her hair?
Dark.
Smith hadn't caught her name, but she had a roommate or roommates. They were college students clearing out a rented house before they scattered for the summer.
How much did you pay for the badge? $20. I tried talking her down, but she wouldn't budge, the little bitch. She was hard-nosed. I think she must have been French.
By French, he meant Franco-American. Many of the people living this close to the New Brunswick border were descended from Acadians who had hid in the forests when the British decided to round up the first settlers and transport the ones who surrendered. Thousands perished on the ship voyages. Le Grand Dérangement, as this wretched episode came to be called, was an act of genocide noteworthy only in that it had been committed by Europeans against Europeans. Some of those Acadians or Cajuns ended up in Louisiana, where they would end up inventing Zydeco music, crawfish etouffee, and one of the most colorful dialects in the English language. I was of Acadian descent on my mother's side. Did she have an accent? I asked.
No.
Then what makes you say she seemed French?
She was wearing makeup. The women up in the St. John Valley are all into cosmetics and dyeing their hair, like the chicks in the bars in Quebec City. You ever been there?
I doubt you and I frequent the same drinking establishments. Did you tell Charlie Stevens about this woman?
Yeah, but he didn't believe me. He was sure I'd stolen that badge, or gotten it from someone who'd stolen it. Please, dude! My balls are turning into ice cubes here!
This I believed. I started the engine and turned us toward shore. A dozen or so units, local, county, and state, had responded to the report of the shooting. Smith was on his way to the jail in Holton, handcuffed to the D-ring on the floor of a deputy's cruiser. Other deputies were engaged in executing a search warrant that had been granted before I could even change my socks. The district warden had been dispatched to the south end of the lake to tow back Smith's boat, provided the aluminum hull hadn't been pierced by the log it had struck. The officer in charge was a state police detective named Xanadakis, and he had some questions for me. He was a trim man with a tanning booth tan who wore cologne purchased somewhere other than a drugstore. Beneath a navy trench coat, he wore a gray sharkskin suit that shone like silver and a tie with a houndstooth pattern. Forget about northern Maine. Nico Xanadakis would have been considered a dandy if he'd worked out of a precinct in Lower Manhattan's financial district. We stood beside his unmarked cruiser while I towel-dried my hair. I'd had a few minutes to change into a fresh set of clothes before Xanadakis arrived. We knew each other from a case long ago. Two drug dealers had gotten lost in the woods in a blizzard. Then things turned violent. Since we'd first met, I'd been promoted and he'd been transferred. But our shared history didn't mean he held warm feelings for me.
Why are you here exactly?
A yellow paste of wet pollen covered the top and hood of the cruiser. My hand came away looking like it was smeared with mustard. I got a report that Smith was dealing illegal taxidermy, migratory birds.
Isn't that a matter for the feds?
I didn't want to bother the Fish and Wildlife Service agents with it until I could scope him out myself. The lie had worked with Deputy Young, so why not again? He jotted something in his reporter's notebook.
So your visit here was unofficial then?
Insofar as I'm not on the clock.
So he took off out the back when you knocked on his door, but if you never spoke to him, how did he know you were law enforcement?
Mr. Smith seems to fear individuals on both sides of the law.
But you are 100% certain that he fired at you after you identified yourself as police?
100%.
That's the key thing here. You understand that, right? The Attorney General's office won't go for an attempted homicide charge if there's any wiggle room.
The neighbor Glassman heard the whole thing.
Speaking of which, Mr. Glassman said you pushed him out of his own boat?
Exigent circumstances required me to pursue Mr. Smith. I didn't know his state of mind, and I realized I couldn't put a bystander in harm's way. Between you and me, how much trouble am I in with him?
My guess is that the satisfaction of losing Mr. Smith as a neighbor will prevail over Mr. Glassman's hurt pride. But if he talks to a lawyer, all bets are off.
One of the troopers on the scene called to Xanadakis.
Nico, you'll want to have a look at what's inside the garage. Remember the woman who reported all those fur coats stolen?
If this had happened in southern Maine, Trooper Danny Tate might have been the one to discover Smith's loot. I had sent her an email that morning, but hadn't heard from her yet. Her range qualification was a 2-day commitment, though. Maybe she'd been pressed for time and hadn't had a moment to respond. The first rumble of thunder rolled up the lake. The clouds to the south looked oily, they were so black. Detective Xanadakis snapped his notebook shut.
Keep your phone on.
I can't promise I'll have a signal where I'm headed.
You wardens always use that as an excuse.
East of Holton, Interstate 95 crosses the border into New Brunswick and joins the Trans-Canada Highway system that connects St. John's, Newfoundland with Victoria, British Columbia. The crossing is one of the busiest land-based ports of entry in the United States. Hundreds of 18-wheelers carrying thousands of tons of cargo pass back and forth between the two countries every week. In a torrential downpour, I left the interstate at the last exit and followed the cloverleaf down to a cluster of truck stops and fast food franchises along Route 1. I figured I would have better cell service here, across the street from a Walmart, than in the woods of Island Falls. And I was right.
Grasshopper, said Kathy Frost. I didn't expect to hear from you so soon, but I bet I know why you're calling. It's Danny, right? You're calling for advice to the lovelorn.
What's wrong with Danny?
There it is, right there. She misses you, man. You couldn't have made time to see her since you've been home.
She told me not to. She said she was busy.
Oh, Mike, you're so hopeless. Sometimes I think your wolf will be easier to domesticate than you.
What am I missing?
She was going to stay over at my house last night since I live close to the practice range. But she didn't want me to catch her bug. Your girl is seriously sick.
Do you think it's bad?
When was the last time you remember that little badass admitting she was ill?
I couldn't recall a single instance. Rain drummed on the roof. The windows began to steam.
So, if it's not Danny, Kathy asked, what do you need?
Who says I need something?
It's the only time you ever call me, my friend.
Kathy's last days as a Maine game warden, after she had been shot and nearly killed, were spent sitting in a cubicle in our Augusta headquarters compiling an official history of the Maine Warden Service. The higher-ups would not permit her to return to the field due to the severity of her injuries, and for once I had been in agreement with my so-called superiors. It had taken 2 weeks for everyone to realize that Kathy Frost was not cut out for office life, and the history remained unfinished. I had no idea how far she'd gotten, but I was hoping. I found an old warden badge from an antiques dealer
and I want to know whose it was.
I hated lying to her, but it didn't stop me.
I was committed to protecting Charlie at all costs to my other relationships.
How old? She asked.
Not sure, but it's shaped like the current badges, smaller, with the district number stamped on the bottom. The number is 113.
Offhand, that doesn't ring a bell. If you want to hang on a minute, I can look it up in my files.
Weren't you supposed to leave those files behind when you retired?
She gave one of her hearty laughs.
Everyone takes something when they leave. I'll call you back in 5 minutes with what I found.
While I waited, I struggled with whether to come clean with Kathy. She had saved my career when I was set on blowing it to pieces, and I trusted her with my life. If my investigation had involved anyone else but Charlie, I would have already spilled my guts to her.
A few guys had that number over the years, she said when she called back. But I'm guessing the badge you found belonged to a warden named Duke Dupree. That was his actual first name, before you ask. He worked out of Clayton Lake and Churchill Depot during the Depression.
Never heard of him.
That's no surprise. His service was, shall we say, abbreviated.
Did he die in the line of duty?
You've been to the memorial enough times. Do you remember seeing his name on it?
She meant the granite monument in Augusta on which were carved the names of every Maine police officer who had perished while carrying out his or her job.
Dupree fell asleep at the wheel and plowed his cruiser into a couple of sweethearts outside Ashland. Lucky for him, he lived in a time before social media. The warden service hushed it up, but Dupree lost his job. They must have let him keep his badge as a memento. Policies weren't so strict back then. I'm not surprised it ended up at a yard sale. Where did you find it?
I had to take a breath before I could lie again.
Presque Isle.
What are you doing there?
I thought I'd do some fishing up in the Dabuli Reserve. I figured it would be cooler in the county. My mistake.
Because there's no more enjoyable time to land a few Arctic char than peak blackfly season. Are you sure you want to stick with that story, Grasshopper?
No, but I'm going to.
Give my best to Shas while you're up there.
Who?
Remember Shas LaMontagne? He's the warden up that way.
It's a shame he's such a Boy Scout.
My God, what a handsome hunk he is. Good luck with the fishing.
Kathy knew me too well. We are always more transparent to our friends than we are to ourselves. Chapter 18. The summer solstice had just passed. The days were as long as they would ever be, but the thunderheads had brought a premature dusk with them. The pole lights outside the truck stop blazed brightly enough to illuminate a stadium. I decided to grab a meal at the diner before calling Aura with an update. She had been good about not messaging, but the silence on her end was ominous, too. It meant that she hadn't heard anything from her missing husband. My phone rang as I crossed the puddled parking lot. I didn't recognize the number, but the location of the caller was given as Indian Township.
Mike, it's Nick Francis.
Thanks for calling back.
My granddaughter said you stopped by the house looking for me.
His Passamaquoddy accent was incredibly faint, noticeable in the dropping of G's at the end of his present participles.
She said you were headed up to Holton.
Yeah, I've been dealing with my boy. Probably will be for a couple of days.
Really? I'm in Holton now. I'm at the truck stop near the I-95 exit. Have you had supper?
It's 4 o'clock. I may be old, but I ain't one of them early birds. I'll pick up the tab. Whatever you want from me must be expensive.
Just some background information about a personal case I'm working.
Ain't nothing more expensive than information.
His tone was light, but I could sense that he was debating accepting my invitation.
Look, I know you're looking for Charlie. I already told Aura to give the man some time. He'll show up eventually. He always does.
Then why not get a free meal out of me?
I heard him suck on a cigarette while he considered the offer.
I guess I could use a diversion from the family problems I've been dealing with. I'm down at the hospital now.
Should take me 15 minutes to get there.
The hospital? Are you all right?
He replied with a laugh tinged with sadness.
I'll see you in 15.
When they were young men, Nick and Charlie had worked investigations together on and around Down East tribal lands, including several cases that Charlie refused to discuss with me. One involved the notorious gang rape and murder of a Passamaquoddy girl at Pleasant Point. The five alleged perpetrators, local white men, were never arrested or brought to trial, but I gathered that their identities had been all but confirmed.
It was a different era, Charlie had said. There were different standards of law for whites and Indians in Washington County.
He refused to say more, which had only increased my interest. Researching the case, I had learned that both the gang's ringleader and his sidekick had died when their fishing boat had sunk in Copscook Bay. The Coast Guard and Maine law enforcement agencies had conducted an investigation that had lasted months. Just about every Indian in Pleasant Point seemed to have been interrogated, but had come up empty. Charlie wouldn't have been a party to murder, but Nick Francis? I wasn't so sure. I was on the verge of ordering supper when in through the diner door came a squat but handsome man in his 70s. Despite his age, his full head of hair was still a dark blackish brown, and he had a face that must have been boyish before wrinkles and weathered skin had finally given it gravitas. His hair and shoulders were wet. It must have started raining again. He wore a loose linen shirt, probably to conceal a gun tucked inside his waistband, chinos, and loafers. The only item that hinted at his tribal identity was a bead bracelet worn on the same wrist as a battered old Timex. On his forehead, a hemophilic bandage covered what I guessed were no less than a dozen new stitches. Everyone I met these days had been battered, one way or another.
Nick?
Mike?
The hand I shook was hard with calluses. The fingertips were stained yellow from nicotine. He settled into the booth across from me, hands hidden beneath the tabletop. I had always felt uncomfortable around Nick Francis. He seemed to blink less than normal people, seemed always to be staring. But it was his perpetual smile that weirded me out. When his face was at rest, the corners of his broad mouth remained upturned, giving him a cat-like expression. More than other Native Americans I had met, he made me aware of the vast distance between our life experiences. "Don't presume to know me," those hard black eyes seemed to state. I tried to affect more ease than I felt.
"I have to ask about the bandage."
"The boy and me had a difference of opinion. I shouldn't have let it escalate."
"Your son did that?"
The waitress appeared with coffee, which I eagerly accepted. Nick ordered a Pepsi, no ice.
"I'll cut to the chase," I said. "I'm concerned about Charlie."
"Have you contacted the FAA?
"He didn't take his plane."
"That ain't good."
"It gets worse. He left me a note telling me not to come looking for him."
"Seems like maybe you should honor his wishes. Charlie has reasons for the things he does. It don't always make sense to anyone but him, but you need to respect his choices."
"I would if not for Aura."
"Charlie understood the worry it would cause her. Maybe he reckoned she'd be even more worried if she knew where he was going."
"It ain't your business in any case, and you're smart enough to know that, kid."
Two Border Patrol agents came in and whispered to the hostess. She guided them to seats in a corner booth. They sat beside each other so each had a clear view of the room. Cops of all stripes have an aversion to sitting with their backs to doors. When I was younger, I had sat against plenty of walls. But after so many close encounters with death, I knew I wasn't going to die like Wild Bill Hickok, shot by some loser coming through a door with a pistol blasting. I returned my attention to Nick Francis. "Have you ever heard of a game warden named Duke Dupree? He was a warden back during the Depression."
"I'm old, kid, but not that old."
"This Dupree's badge showed up at the pop-up flea market at the Machias Dyke. I'm positive it's the reason for Charlie's strange behavior, that badge." He rested his left hand on the laminated menu before him. Only then did I see he was missing the ring finger.
"You're going to keep working it no matter what I say."
"You know I will." I half expected him to get up and leave. Instead, he cracked the first real smile he'd shown me since he'd sat down.
Then we'd better order food so you can start telling the story. You going to talk to that college girl tomorrow? He asked when I'd finished. If I can find her. What street did you say she lives on?
I told him. I thought he might offer his assistance, but he didn't.
You've known Charlie a long time, I said. In his note to me, he mentioned the worst mistake a man can make. What do you think he meant by that?
Killing someone, he said matter-of-factly.
That was my thought, too. Suddenly, Nick tilted his head back and looked at the ceiling.
What?
I asked.
Killing the wrong someone.
That's the worst mistake a man can make?
For Charlie, it would be.
But he never killed anyone. Not after Vietnam, I mean. Nick's reaction was to glance at the corner booth where the two Border Patrol agents were finishing their meals with strawberry shortcake and cups of coffee.
Is that what he told you? He asked.
You're saying he lied to me?
I'm not sure why you think Charlie owed you the story of his life.
A thought occurred to me. I couldn't have explained why. I reached into my pocket and brought out the snapshot Aura had found in Charlie's cigar box, the picture of the bare-faced man. I pushed it across the glass-topped table.
Where'd you get that? Nick asked.
It was my turn to be the one slowly doling out information.
Do you know who this is?
Of course.
Well, that's Pierre Michaud.
Who's Pierre Michaud?
The man Charlie killed.
What? Nick reached into the chest pocket of his shirt, removed a crushed pack of cigarettes, and set it on the table. The brand was Natural American Spirit. The illustration on the package showed an Indian in eagle feather headdress inhaling tobacco from a long pipe.
You mind continuing this conversation outside? I could use a smoke.
But I sensed his real motive. He didn't want to be overheard. Chapter 19. The rain had stopped, and a mist was rising from the asphalt. We wandered off past the chugging 18-wheelers, past the arc lights, past the drop-off where the asphalt crumbled. We entered a field of wildflowers and weeds. It was too early in the summer for crickets, but I heard other unknown insects clicking from the shadowed ground. And a few fireflies flickered farther out in the tall grass.
People listen better in the dark, I found, he said.
I was listening to you inside, he chuckled.
You weren't listening. You were letting your eyes rest on me while you thought about yourself.
He had me there.
You ever hear what happened at St. Ignace?
He said in the brief glow of the Zippo he used to light his cigarette.
Up in the St. John Valley? I said.
An undercover game warden disappeared. He was presumed murdered by the group of poachers he had infiltrated. The warden service tore apart the town looking for him. A few buildings burned to the ground in the raid. Politically, it was a shit show for the department. The colonel at the time was forced to resign.
That's one version, Nick said,
exhaling smoke I could taste on the tip of my tongue.
Everyone who was there that night tells a different story. Keep in mind, I only know what I heard. I was the police chief in Indian Township at the time and had enough shit to handle with my own people.
You're saying that Charlie was the one who shot and killed the ringleader, this Michaud guy?
That's right.
How is it possible that I never heard about this?
The exchange of gunfire happened at night on Bow Lac. That's almost as far north in Maine as you can go. The international border runs right down the center of the lake. Charlie only winged the man, but the shot knocked him out of his canoe. Michaud drowned trying to swim to the Canadian shore.
In the darkness of the rain-soaked field, I was half hypnotized by the orange glow of his cigarette as it danced through the air like yet another firefly. You didn't answer my question. How have I never heard about this? The warden service got raked over the coals pretty good, like you said. Both the U.S. attorney and the Maine attorney general found Charlie was justified in his actions. Michaud was a cop killer. Everyone had an interest in putting the scandal to bed. But they never found the undercover warden, no matter how hard they searched. I closed my eyes and tried to see the granite memorial in Augusta devoted to law enforcement officers who had died in the line of duty. "Scott Pellerin," I said. "That was his name?" "Smart kid. Too cocky for his own good, though. Charlie said it must have been how he blew his cover. Overconfidence." The occasional rumble of big rigs passing along the highway made me think the storms were returning. How does the badge fit into this? Both Pellerin and Dupree are French names. You should check out if they were related. There might be a connection. "You seem to be working on a theory," I said. "Am I?" That Charlie always regretted Michaud's death because it kept him from finding Pellerin? That's why he kept that picture in a box with his other trophies? For some reason, the reappearance of Duke Dupree's badge has made him rethink the events of 15 years ago. He realized he had been misled.
"Is that my theory?" said Nick. "I'm smarter than I thought."
"It explains why Charlie would want to check things out on his own, in case the man who murdered Pellerin has been preparing for the day when he was finally found out." Nick tossed the orange ember of his cigarette into the weeds.
"It also explains why he took his truck instead of his plane. He might have had a bunch of stops to make, people to talk with along the way. That old Ford Ranger of his is distinctive. Folks might remember it if you ask."
"It sounds like you're encouraging me to go after him."
"You're gonna do what you're gonna do. That's your M.O., I've heard."
"So if Michaud didn't kill Pellerin, who did?"
"One of his Confederates."
"In his letter, Charlie said he didn't want to put his family or me in danger. From whom, though? Some poacher who wasn't caught in the raid? Sure, a guy who thinks he got away with killing a game warden is going to be dangerous. But you did this job too, Nick. We've all dealt with scarier people than some toothless old night hunter."
"A toothless man can put a bullet in you just as fast as one with a mouthful of choppers. 15 years ain't that long ago either. This mystery man might not be that old."
"I was speaking metaphorically."
"Seems like Scott Pellerin got killed for underestimating the men he was infiltrating. That's a mistake Charlie isn't going to make. You'd best follow his example and keep your guard up."
I listened to a toad trilling across the field. "So where do you think Charlie is now?"
"Your guess is as good as mine."
"He'll want to talk with the girl who sold Smith the badge," I said.
"That would be my assumption, but he can't risk giving himself away.
He's the man who shot Pierre Michaud, remember?
People in the valley have long memories, even if the rest of the world has forgotten what happened up there."
I hadn't thought of that.
"So you're determined to pursue this?"
"In the morning."
"I can recommend the motel across the parking lot."
"Is that where you're staying?"
"I have a lady friend up in Mars Hill."
Nick Francis had lots of lady friends, from what I'd heard. "I don't suppose you want to come with me tomorrow, play investigator again?" He had a chain smoker's laugh.
"Old men shouldn't be running around chasing after thrills. They should be content in the arms of their family. Besides, I have to stick around Holton until Tuesday."
"What happens Tuesday?"
"My son is being arraigned, and he's going to need me to pay his bail again."
Following Nick's recommendation, I took a room at the motel across from the truck stop. A sign on the dresser threatened anyone caught smoking with a $250 fine. Based on the odor baked into the rug, the penalty hadn't deterred a prior occupant. It could have been that I was smelling the residue of Nick Francis's cigarettes. My clothing reeked of American spirits. I hung them from the shower rod with the window open to air out. I was curious about Nick's son, Molly's dad. The fact of the younger man being in jail might have explained the bandage on the father's forehead. One of Charlie's favorite sayings came to mind. "Some people are more than they appear, and some people are less than they appear. But nobody is the way they appear." But surely he couldn't have fooled me. Not after all the adventures we'd lived through. The decision before me, choosing to believe in Charlie's essential goodness, seemed to have momentous importance, as if in making it, I wasn't just defending my friend, but also somehow defining myself. Because I had been betrayed before by trusting in the character of a person I'd thought I'd understood, I had vowed never to be fooled again, no matter the circumstances. But I couldn't live my life distrusting the people closest to me. I made my decision. I trusted Charlie. Kathy had been true to her word. When I opened my email, there was a message with the subject line, Duke Dupree! He killed himself after his draft board refused his application to join the army after Pearl Harbor. His wife found him in the outhouse with the shotgun at his feet and half his head blown off. That's the legend in Millinocket, anyhow. Of course you won't see this message since you're deep in the woods at Dabuli Pond with no signal. I hope the char are biting. P.S. Call Danny. Dupree, having committed suicide, explained why his badge had held no particular value to his next of kin. The shield symbolized his dishonor. Dupree might even have pawned the badge before his death. Who could say how many hands it had passed through over the decades? As intriguing as this information was, it brought me no closer to understanding why Charlie had reacted the way he had when he saw the badge on Smith's table. What connection did he have to a failed game warden who died before he was born? If anything, I felt myself to be at a greater loss than I'd been before I read Kathy's message. Meanwhile, Aura was waiting. I could picture her in the camp, in her wheelchair with the green blanket over her knees, Vivaldi playing on the old cassette stereo. I owed her the truth, I realized. I couldn't have it both ways. In order to trust, I needed also to be trustworthy.
Where are you?
Was her first question. I'm at a motel in Holton. Did you find Mr. Smith? As if the jackass deserved to be called Mr., I thought. But that was Aura Stevens. She would grant the devil the dignity of being addressed with an honorific. She listened to my account of the day without interruption until I came to the part of the story where I'd met Nick Francis, and he'd brought up the bungled undercover investigation 15 years earlier.
"This has to do with that man Michaud," she said,
her voice rising as the truth became clear to her.
"He is the one in the picture in Charlie's cigar box."
"Yes."
"I should have recognized him, but when it happened, I couldn't bring myself to read the papers. The grief was too much for me, and I could tell how greatly Charlie was suffering. Of course, this is all about Scott. It's the only explanation that makes sense."
"What connection did Scott Pellerin have with Charlie?"
"Oh, Mike," she said. "Scott Pellerin was once you."
Chapter 20. While we talked, I opened the browser on my phone and brought up the Warden Service website. I found the page dedicated to fallen officers. In his commemorative photo, Scott Pellerin was wearing the same dress uniform, red coat and short-brimmed green Stetson, that I had worn the day I was sworn into service. His eyes were an unremarkable brown. His hair was an unremarkable brown. Perhaps it was the anonymity of his features that had made his superiors think him suitable for undercover work. Scott Pellerin had a face you could easily forget.
"They were like father and son," Aura said. "Scott's own father was a merchant mariner and alcoholic. His mother was one of those enablers. Scott never had a male role model until he met Charlie."
The resemblance to my own life story wasn't exact, but close enough to be unsettling.
"Of course you and Scott had different personalities," Aura continued, "and there wasn't anything between him and Stacy. She was just a teenager when he died, busy with her friends."
Still, I was surprised Stacy had never mentioned this Pellerin to me. Maybe she hadn't realized the extent of her father's connection to the young man. She had been a rebellious teen, uninterested in her parents' lives. A typical adolescent, in other words.
"When you say we had different personalities, what do you mean?" "Scott wasn't as well educated as you, but he was extremely intelligent.
He was quiet, but not shy. Strangers seemed to warm to him easily, maybe because he seemed so interested in people, unlike me. What else? You were both brave to the point of being foolhardy. Scott loved taking risks. He probably would have grown out of it, as you have. Charlie had been teaching him to fly, and he was close to getting his pilot's license when... You know what happened. Not really, I said. All I know is that he was working undercover in St. Ignace, infiltrating a group of poachers, and that someone must have gotten suspicious because he didn't make his scheduled rendezvous with his handler. Stanley Kellum, the lieutenant, was Scott's handler. I had met Stan the Man Kellum a dozen times before his retirement. He used to run Division E, which included the entirety of Aroostook County, roughly the size of Connecticut and Rhode Island combined. Did they have a starting point for the search? Scott mentioned that the poachers kept an illegal camp near Tornado Path on the Allegash River, so that was where they focused initially. They dredged Round Pond, which is just above the path. I've been there, I said. Remember when Stacy and I paddled the Allegash? Oh, yes, I had forgotten. I heard the tinkling sound of ice in a glass, her nightcap. The search expanded to include the entire waterway, south to Chamberlain Lake and east to Ashland, and then west to the Quebec border and north to Estcourt Station. She was describing a search area of 1,000 square miles. Tell me about this Pierre Michaud. I only know what Charlie told me, that he was a horrible man. He shot people's cats with an air gun for sport. He had 2 sons just as bad. They were all poachers. There were other men involved, too. I don't remember the names. I couldn't bear to read or watch the news then. I was so heartbroken. What did the Michauds say when they were confronted with Pellerin's disappearance? They said they had no idea where he'd gone. They pretended not to know he was a warden. That was how Charlie knew there was a conspiracy to murder Scott, because they all told the same exact story. Normally, the details of their accounts would have differed. So Michaud and the others were interrogated. The detectives held the poachers as long as they could. Scott had recorded evidence to charge a few of them with crimes, but they had to let the father go after 48 hours. Pierre had been careful around Scott and never broke the law in his presence. Or, this is difficult, but I need to know what Charlie told you about how Pierre Michaud died. The police and wardens went back to St. Ignace a few nights later. They had new evidence against Michaud. They used flashbang grenades when they stormed his house, but he must have rigged it with explosives or incendiaries because it went up in flames and took 2 other houses with it. Charlie says it was a diversion to cover Michaud's escape. They searched for him for days. Charlie did aerial surveillance, of course. By sheer luck, he spotted a canoe crossing Bow Lac late at night. The moon had broken through the clouds. Charlie landed the plane on the water, you know how difficult that is at night. And Michaud fired at him, and he fired back. The man would have lived if he hadn't tried to swim in that cold water. Some people, including the press, called it an act of revenge, but Michaud was the only one who knew where Scott's body was hidden. They never did find it. Secretly, I understood the reluctance of people in the St. John Valley to accept this story as the truth. Hundreds of men had been searching thousands of miles of dense forest for the fugitive. What were the odds of Charlie Stevens flying over Bow Lac at the exact hour Michaud had chosen to cross the border? You need to go see Stanley Kellum, Aura said. Stanley used to go out on his own time for years afterward looking for clues that would lead him to the truth. Charlie said he was guilt-ridden for sending Scott to his death. Do you have a phone number for Lieutenant Kellum? I remember Charlie saying that Stanley left the state after he retired. It sounds crazy, but I thought he said the man was going back to college. Do you have any idea where? I'll check the Rolodex and give you a call back. Oh, Mike, I'm sure this is the explanation for why Charlie is acting so strangely. Something about this badge has made him think he can find Scott. Let's hope so, I said. And you're certain you've never heard the name Duke Dupree? I'm sure I haven't. I put the phone down beside me on the bedspread. Then I found the complimentary pen and notepaper from the motel desk and began scribbling down as much information as I could recall from my conversations that evening. The idea of Stan Kellum going back to college after his retirement wasn't as far-fetched as Aura thought. He had been one of those larger-than-life characters who often rise to positions of power. We hadn't crossed paths in years, but I found I could see him clearly in my memory. A massive brute of a man. Gray eyes, dirty blonde hair, a perpetual pink sunburn, and one of the most brilliant minds in the history of the Maine Warden Service. While many of the old-school wardens boasted 12th-grade educations at best, Kellum had graduated from Rutgers, and he had not abandoned his studies over the course of his long career. While overseeing Division E, a job that must have consumed 60 hours a week, he had quietly obtained a master's degree in criminology from the University of Maine. At his retirement roast, he joked about getting a PhD next. I also recall that Kellum had come into a considerable bit of life insurance money when his most recent wife died in a car crash. There was some gossip that Stan might have played a role in her convenient demise. Not all the gossip was kidding. There were no messages from Danny, no voicemails, no emails, no texts. This was unusual for her. Unheard of would be the more accurate phrase. Charlie had already dropped off the radar. I didn't need my girlfriend following suit. Aura phoned me back before I could call Danny. "All I could find for Stanley was a post office box in Portage," she said. "I thought the address must be out of date, so I made a call to Tim Malcolm." She was referring to the head of the warden service. "What did the colonel tell you?" "Stanley's back in Maine." I hadn't heard that. "He purchased an old sporting camp west of Portage and turned it into his own private compound. It's over on Moccasin Pond. I think I know the old camp Kellum bought." I remembered seeing it advertised in the Maine Sportsman and the Northwoods Sporting Journal. It had been on the market for $1 million. "I just wish Charlie would let me know he's okay," said Aura. "He is." "How can you be certain?" "Because of you." "Me?" "If something had happened to Charlie, you would have sensed it. I'm not clairvoyant, Mike. I just get feelings. Those are called premonitions. Have you had any about your husband?" "No." "Then you need to trust yourself." "Since when have you started believing in premonitions, Mike Bowditch?" "I've seen too many things I can't explain," I said. "Human mysteries are nothing compared to the mysteries of the universe." The air coming through the window screens was so saturated with moisture that it formed dew on the sills. I tried closing the windows and running the AC, but the unit made a sick rattling sound that I feared would keep me up all night. I sat down on the bed and found the mattress unforgiving. Then I made the call.
"Hi,"
Danny said.
"I expected to hear from you. How was your day on the shooting range?"
"I qualified, but just barely. I think it was the heat. My face was brick red," the guy said. Danny was a natural marksman. Some people have to train and train, but her skills were as close to God-given as I had seen. It was as if she'd been born with the muscle memory of having fired thousands of shots. Annie Oakley reincarnated. "Maybe it was heat stroke."
"I just had a bad day."
"You might want to take a cool bath, not too cold."
"I don't have heat stroke," she said. "To top it all off, I picked up a tick somewhere. I found it attached to my thigh, full of blood, like it had been there a while."
Was it a deer tick or a dog tick? The question mattered because the former carried Lyme disease while the latter did not.
"Deer tick. You need to get that checked out."
"I will if I see a bullseye rash." "It wouldn't hurt to get your doctor to prescribe some antibiotics anyway. Lyme isn't something you can blow off."
"Mike, I told you I'll keep an eye on it."
"How many ticks did you used to find on yourself when you were a patrol warden?"
"No offense, but I'm tired of talking about my sucky day."
"Has Charlie reappeared?"
"No, but I think I am beginning to understand what this is about."
"Let's hear it."
She listened quietly to my monologue.
That, too, was atypical. Usually, Danny interrupted me with questions or theories whenever I told her about a case I was working on. She had the mind of a detective and couldn't help herself. When I had finished, she said, "Be careful of Stan Kellum."
"What do you mean?"
"Kathy never told you about him? Stan the man was her lieutenant when she was a rookie."
"Please don't tell me he sexually harassed her," I said, thinking of Tom Wheelwright.
"Worse. He tried to persuade her to quit after her husband died in that car crash. He badgered her about it for weeks after she came back from bereavement leave, like because she was a woman she must be suffering so bad she couldn't do the job. He put her on a desk until she forced him to let her return to patrol."
"Kathy never told me any of this."
"That's because you're a man," Danny said. "She's your friend and all, but this is the kind of thing women have trouble sharing except with other women. She never came as close to quitting as during that stretch of time."
"I'll ask her about him.
If she even wants to talk."
"Sorry. I'm not being the best listener tonight. I've got a wicked headache."
"I'm glad that son of a bitch Smith didn't shoot you."
"That makes two of us."
"I'll hit you back in the morning," she said. "I just need to get some sleep."
"If you're still not feeling well."
"Good night, Mike. Love you."
"Good night."
Chapter 21. The next morning dawned as hot as sunrise in the Congo. I stepped outside with a cup of coffee I had brewed in the little machine atop the bureau. The rhythmic thumping of truck tires on the bridge over Route 1 carried across the parking lot. The sound of commerce. House sparrows were picking dead bugs out of the grills of the semis in the parking lot. Logan Kronk, up early, had sent along pictures of Shadow to assure me my captive canine was alive and well. The black wolf must have slept beneath an evergreen because his fur had become coated with saffron pollen. The big animal appeared nearly phosphorescent, my very own hound of the Baskervilles. I ate breakfast in the diner, scrambled eggs, bacon, and a molasses donut, and gassed up my truck, knowing the length of the drive ahead of me. In the county, it paid to fill your tank whenever you could, since opportunities could be few and far between. I was eager to get started. Presque Isle is what passes for a big city in Aroostook County. I do not mean that as a slight. 9,000 residents is significant anywhere in a state as rural as Maine. Presque Isle is home to 3 institutions of higher learning. It has an actual airport with commercial flights, only 2 a day, but it's something. The first successful transatlantic balloon launched from Presque Isle and landed safely outside Paris in 1978. But if you ask anyone up north about the city, they'll say its real claim to fame is potatoes. Prized above all others for making French fries, the Kennebec variety are harvested by tons in the fall, processed by factories that perfume the air with a pleasantly starchy aroma, and then trucked and shipped around the world. I approached the city through vast fields of potatoes. Being June, there wasn't much to see, just endless furrows of dirt stretching to distant tree lines. In a few weeks, however, the plants would begin to blossom until the city of Presque Isle was adrift in a sea of flowers. On windy summer days, petals would tumble along the ground, purple, pink, and white. The sun was showing through the clouds, a blurred disk, when I turned onto a street of ranch homes with mowed yards and gardens bright with peonies and hydrangeas, not having an address, a name, or even a description of the young woman beyond her shapely breasts. It made no sense to guess which house might be hers. I was looking instead for a certain type of person that you will find in any neat residential neighborhood, the busybody. I found her soon enough. Noting the slowness of my vehicle, she opened her curtains to have a better look at me. When I reached the end of the street and doubled back, moving even more slowly now, she emerged onto her front porch. I stopped the scout when I'd drawn even with her tidy house and rolled down the window and hung my arm out. I shut off the engine.
"Hello? I'm wondering if you can help me?"
She was a short wisp of a woman with rosy cheeks and a long gray braid, I doubt if she weighed 90 pounds. She wore a purple smock, linen pants, Birkenstocks, and reading glasses propped atop her head. A wedding ring hung on a chain around her neck.
Are you lost, then?
Not exactly. I'm trying to find a young woman who lives on this street, Mrs.
And what would her name be?
I'm afraid I don't know.
Maybe you should put an ad in the newspaper under missed connections.
She had the accent I had come to associate with natives of northern Maine, flat vowels and hard R's. First-time visitors to Aroostook County often remark on how Midwestern it feels. They don't just mean the enormous blue skies and rolling farmland. They're also taken aback by pronunciations, which don't remotely resemble the Down East stereotype. The Aroostook accent sounds like something you might hear in a Milwaukee beer house or at a Nebraska Grange Hall. I produced my badge and identification card. She took her time bringing her reading glasses into position to read them. After a thorough review, she lifted the glasses off her nose and stared into my eyes with fierce intention.
If she's a poacher, you're looking in the wrong neighborhood.
Actually, I think she's a student at one of the colleges, living with a couple of other girls. They had a yard sale not too long ago. The girl I need to talk to has dark hair and is, buxom? Her eyes twinkled.
Buxom? Haven't heard that expression since Jane Russell was on TV selling brassieres. That would be Angie Bouchard.
Can you point me to her house?
Only if you tell me why you need to talk to her.
Ms. Bouchard sold something at her yard sale. I'd like to ask where she got it.
Was it that badge?
You saw it?
Course I did. I was there with the other early birds before she opened up. Is she in trouble for selling that thing?
No.
Yeah, well, wouldn't surprise me if she were. She and her friends threw the kinds of parties that attract men on motorcycles. I can't say I'm sad she's moving out. Blue house, white trim, number 84.
Thank you, Mrs.
That badge of yours is real, I hope. You're not one of those police impersonators.
The badge is real. I found a dog-eared business card in my wallet and handed it to her. She took it without a word. When I restarted my truck, she was standing on the front steps, trying to get a clear view down the street of what was about to happen. There were no motorcycles parked outside the blue house, but there was a muddy pickup pulled up to the curb, someone's old beater. More notable was the flashy Volkswagen Golf GTI in the open garage. The white hatchback still had the temporary cardboard plate the dealer gives you before you drive off the lot. The new car might mean something, or it might mean nothing. It might not even belong to Angie Bouchard. I rang the bell, positioned the badge on my belt so that it was in plain sight, and stepped back from the door so I could be viewed from head to foot through the peephole. The young woman who answered the door had hazel eyes and a rat's nest of brownish-black hair. She was as voluptuous as Smith had claimed. She wore a T-shirt with the Earth Mother logo, jeans with holes in the knees, and a fringe of loose threads at her bare ankles. I judged her to be older than most college students, mid-twenties. She held an unlighted hand-rolled cigarette pinched between two fingers. Angie Bouchard?
Yeah?
I produced my badge for her. I'm Mike Bowditch. I'm a warden investigator for the state of Maine. Her untrimmed eyebrows tightened.
What's that?
She had an entirely different accent from her busybody neighbor. The inflection was faint, but undeniably French.
What's that?
I'm a detective who works for the Maine Warden Service, but still a police officer. Can I come in?
Fuck no. I don't let strange men in my house. Cops included.
You had a yard sale here last month?
Yeah.
She kept her voice neutral and face free of surprise, but she knew exactly why I had appeared at her door. The effect of my words was immediate. She stepped out onto the concrete stoop and closed the door behind her. Did you sell a badge like mine at your sale? It would have been smaller, older.
No.
A man in the county jail swears he bought a vintage game warden badge at a yard sale at this address. She produced a Bic lighter from her pocket and brought the cigarette up to her full lips.
My roommate had stuff for sale, too. Could it belong to her?
Is she home? Angie Bouchard exhaled smoke from the corner of her mouth. Only then did I realize the cigarette was an expertly rolled joint. I made a coughing noise that brought an amused light into her eyes. Meg's spending the summer back home in Connecticut. Would you mind putting that thing out until we're done?
It's legal, and it's my house, she said. If you don't approve, you can leave.
Her attitude told me she had dealt with cops before. People who seldom come into contact with the police are rarely so defiant. Was she a bad girl, or was she just pretending to be one? I brought out my notebook. What's Meg's full name? She told me. I pretended to write it down. What brought her all the way to Presque Isle?
Her family is from here originally. They moved to Connecticut after the base closed at Limestone. Went to work for one of the defense firms. Lots of people did. Meg wouldn't have known it was illegal to sell a police badge.
It isn't illegal, unless it was stolen property. What about you, Angie? Where are you from?
Madawaska.
It was an industrial town 2 hours north of Presque Isle in the St. John Valley. Madawaska was noteworthy for having a paper mill with a foot in two nations. The U.S. plant sent liquid wood pulp through a pipeline above the river to the New Brunswick factory to be made into toilet tissue, among other things. Does your father work at the mill? She exhaled marijuana smoke in my face.
How'd you guess?
There aren't too many other jobs in Madawaska other than papermaking.
That depends on what side you're on, she said. There are more opportunities on the Canadian side.
Which side are you on?
My mom was American. My dad is Canadian. I have dual citizenship.
Your mom is dead? The past tense had given her away, and she only now realized it.
She died over the winter. Breast cancer.
I'm sorry for your loss. Mine died of ovarian cancer. Your mother left you some money?
How did you...
The car. Those GTIs are sweet.
What was your mom's name? Emmeline, she said. My mom's name was Emmeline Bouchard.
Was she from Madawaska, too?
Fort Kent.
The town was 20 miles down the river from St. Ignace, where Scott Pellerin had vanished. The badge you... Excuse me, Meg, sold at the yard sale belonged to a man named Duke Dupree. I'm having trouble understanding how a college student from Connecticut got her hands on the badge of a Maine game warden who has been dead for decades. There was a touch of cruelty in her smile.
Too bad she's not here.
You're lying to me about the badge, Angie. I know it was yours. The door flew open behind her. A big, bearded man stood there wearing jeans and nothing else. He had the heavy brow and the powerful chest of a cartoon caveman. Unusual for a man his age in a place like this, he had no tattoos. He did, however, possess what looked like a cattle brand on one muscular shoulder. Raised scar tissue made a circular pattern. He appeared to be late 30s, older than I was, and significantly older than Angie.
"Who the fuck is this?"
he said in the same faintly French accent.
No one, baby.
His eyes were like those of a nocturnal animal, dark brown, alert, a creature that preys upon weaker creatures.
I know a cop when I see one.
I'm a game warden, actually, and you are...
A friend of mine, said Angie quickly.
The man took the joint from her, but was more careful about the direction he blew smoke. He looked so familiar, and yet I was positive we had never met before.
What do you want? He said.
I was asking for tips on having a successful yard sale. The man angled himself in front of his girlfriend, assuming that's who she was. I kept my eyes locked on his, but used my peripheral vision in case he pulled out a weapon.
I think it's time for you to knock on someone else's door, Warden.
A realization took hold of me. Why had it taken so long for me to see the resemblance? From my back pocket, I removed the snapshot Aura had found in Charlie's cigar box and held it out for them to see. The bearded man reacted as if I'd shown him a picture of his own gravestone. The question came out as a snarl.
What the fuck?
My intuition had been proven correct. I assume you know who this is, then.
Where did you get that?
I put the photograph away before he could snatch it from me. It doesn't matter. So which of Pierre Michaud's sons are you?
Who the fuck are you?
I already told Ms. Bouchard. Angie put her hand on Michaud's muscled arm but directed her words at me.
I answered all your questions.
That wasn't anywhere near the truth. I had dozens more for Angie Bouchard and the son of Pierre Michaud.
Get the fuck out of here, he said.
And if I don't? He couldn't speak the threat out loud, but I had seen murder in enough eyes to recognize a warning. Don't come here again. Tough guys always need to have the last word.